Time travel is usually considered the stuff of science fiction, an impossibility except perhaps in a very distant, super advanced future. But is it really so impossible? Today, we'll be discussing two stories of people who believe they've traveled through time. Welcome to Shadowland, everybody.
Welcome.
So, this is a podcast that shines a spotlight on stories of the supernatural, mysterious, eerie, and unexplained. Things like...
wormholes.
Zombies.
Time travelers.
Contemporary dinosaurs.
The soul.
Stargates.
Miracles.
Black elk.
Auras.
Premonitions.
Other dimensions.
Alien abductions.
Stargates. Did I say Stargates?
I said Stargates.
Oh, you said Stargates. Bigfoot.
I did. Maybe we should do Stargates.
I think we should soon.
Soon. Okay. You get the general idea.
Yes. All kinds of stuff like that.
So I'm Christina Callery.
And I'm Seth Jablon.
And today we're going to talk about...
what are we talking about today? Oh, time travel. Specific time traveling types of stories.
Yes. We hunted down stories of two people who actually believe that they traveled through time.
Yes.
Which is pretty cool.
And I think there's, I have an idea of which one you're going to do. So I think there's some similarities between these stories that are going to be pretty cool.
I have no idea what you're going to do.
Yes. But I hope you like it. I'm not sure if you know it or not yet. We almost did the same story, but we were stopped. But yeah, I think that there's an interesting connection between the two. Okay, so who should go first? I think I went first last time.
You went first last time.
Yeah. Do you want me to go again? Because I think you went. It doesn't matter.
Wait.
You said you had a long. You said yours is long.
Mine is pretty long. Yeah.
Okay. Do you want me to go first or second?
It sounds like you want to go first. Okay, I think you should go first.
Okay. Yeah. I think I like going first now.
You do like going first.
You get it out of the way and then I can just chill out. Okay. When you do the heavy lifting. Okay, cool. All right. Are you ready for it?
I'm totally ready.
Okay. So this is the story of Air Marshal Sir Victor Goddard. I think that's how you say his name. Have you heard of this?
I have not.
Okay, good. Okay, so there's a lot of facets to this story. There's like some like cool additional stuff around him that I'll sort of talk about after the story. But the probably most well-known story of his is the story of this flight he took in the year 1935. So it was a Sunday. So obviously he's a pilot and he was going for an overnight visit, like a weekend type trip from his home base in Andover, England, over to an abandoned airfield at Drem, not far from Edinburgh in Scotland. I think he might have been originally intending to go all the way to Edinburgh or something, but decided to go to this land at this abandoned air base, or he sort of flew over it or whatever it was. But basically, this airfield, Drem, had been constructed during the First World War and had since fallen into disrepair. So it was all overgrown and the hangars were falling apart and there was like cows and stuff walking around. So it was probably kind of an interesting sight and maybe that he was just sort of curious about it. But basically, he flies over there and that Monday he goes to fly it home. And then right as he's leaving, this strange sort of storm kicks up, right? And it's kind of like all these like weird sort of like colors, like it's like sort of yellow brown clouds sort of surround him. And he has a lot of problems controlling his aircraft. And he's out there flying, like this is like, you know, the 1930s. He's out there flying a open cockpit plane. So this is pretty intense, right? This isn't like in some like comfy jet. He's like out there basically in the middle of a storm. You know, he's flying over, I think, sort of mountainous terrain. I'm not sure exactly where it was, but, and so he's without radio or, or like navigational instruments. So he's kind of like doesn't know which way he's going and loses control of the plane. And the thing starts to like spin out. And this is really where he starts to see these strange yellow brown clouds that sort of surround him, right? As he's sort of falling faster and faster down. He's finally able to regain control over his plane and like sort of brings it back. And as he does that, suddenly the sky turns bright sunlight again. And now he's reapproaching Drem Airfield, right? Huh. Except this time everything's different looking, right? This time there's actually people walking around, mechanics, and they're all wearing blue coveralls, right? And the hangars look new. There's actually four airplanes there. Three of them were these biplanes that were painted this sort of yellow he didn't recognize. And the fourth was a monoplane. And this was all odd to him because, well, first of all, the Air Force wasn't painting planes that color, and they didn't even have this type of monoplane at the time. They had been invented, but I don't think it was like part of the fleet. And, you know, the other thing that stuck out was the fact that they were wearing these blue overalls because he knew that the Royal Air Force mechanics wore brown, right? And that doesn't maybe sound like a big, huge detail, right? But I mean, I feel like you have to remember it's, you know, these are, you know, this is the military. And if you're used to a certain color uniform, you're going to notice right away if it's a different color, right?
Like, yeah, 100%.
Pretty big deal to see it change overnight. So all of this is like, he thinks is pretty weird. And also because he's like flying over it and no one seems to notice him, right? And so again, you have to think he's flying a little lower. You know, people are probably looking out for small planes landing and it just seems like nobody sees him. And so as he like gets to the other side, like he sort of re-enters this storm and again, sort of like has to like hang in there and sort of navigate through it. But he's able to get back through it and he makes his way back to Andover, right? And so he thinks this is all pretty crazy. His whole experience, the storm's really weird. What he saw at the airfield was really weird. You know, he doesn't know, you know, exactly what happened, but he starts trying to, you know, tell other pilots back at the base about it. Nobody believes him. Everyone thinks it's, you know, he's either drunk or crazy. I feel like everything in the 40s that people couldn't explain was that they were either drunk or crazy. I've been drunk plenty of times, but like, I definitely haven't seen like, you know, strange airfields with people walking around. But eventually he shuts up about it because, I mean, he's a pilot, right? And like, I feel like this is like a recurring theme throughout, you know, all of the sort of like 20th century where pilots would see things, they'd get ridiculed, and then they'd basically eventually have to shut up about it because, you know, you don't want to lose your pilot's license, right? So years go by, and a few years later, he watches as the Royal Air Force actually changes their mechanics overalls to blue and starts painting its planes yellow. And they even introduce a monoplane called the Magister, right? And then he also, I think it's like, at this point, it's like I think it's like 4 years later, something like that. Maybe it's like 1939. And he learns that they've actually renovated Drem Airfield, and now it's back in use, right? So that's basically the experience he had. He doesn't quite talk, like, you know, once he learns about that, he, you know, I think his feeling is that he had this experience where he either, you know, passed through time, maybe forward in time and back through this strange storm, or maybe it was a clairvoyant episode. But basically that's his story. Some other facts about him are really interesting. One, he actually had another, he was a big believer in ESP after all this stuff that happened to him. And he has this other, experience with ESP and clairvoyance, but it's not actually even, him that experiences, it's someone else. And so, this happens in 1946, you know, over a decade later from his original experience, and he's basically he's in China. I guess he's, you know, working there, stationed there, and he's at a party where another officer says he's had a dream about him dying in a plane crash, and he was actually scheduled to fly to Tokyo that night. And basically, he learns that the dream was about him carrying two men and a woman, and the plane starts to ice up, and then they crash on this pebbled beach near some mountains or something like that. So as it turns out, he actually does take two men and a woman on a flight to Tokyo that night, and everything that the guy saw in the dream comes to pass, right? They, as they're flying, his plane ices over. They end up crashing on the Japanese island of Sado, I guess is how you probably say it, and with the Pebble Beach and all. He didn't die, obviously, and no one else was injured. And they actually ended up making a movie about it in 1955 called The Night My Number Came Up, which I haven't seen. But
I love that title.
Yeah, it's pretty good, right? It's very, so like 50s or 40s or whenever it was came out. But yeah, haven't seen it. Yeah, so he's got all these like strange things happening around him in his life. And one more little fun fact, before all this stuff happened, he was actually involved in another strange occurrence. And this happened back in early 1919, just as World War I was ending. And basically, it's that, there's this strange photo that was taken of him and his squadron at the end of the World War. And basically, I think like something like 200 airmen and women are, shot in this single photograph. But it turns out that there's this really like strange ghostly face right next to his, him and his squadron identify as, Airman Freddie Jackson. Now, Jackson was a mechanic who, died just 2 days earlier by walking into a spinning propeller, right? Oh, so this is like right at the end of war, right before the squadron was going to be disbanded, and he gets killed in this very strange way. And so the face is in the photo is actually grinning. I'll send it to you. We'll put it up on the Instagram. But the face is actually grinning. And unlike the other people in the photo, who are like, a lot of them are like, sort of sullen looking, because they had literally just got back from his funeral. So,
whoa.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy? So like,
it was like photobombing.
Yes. Photobombing. And it's funny that, they made jokes about him, the fact that he was grinning. It looks like, I think one of them said it looks like he was like caught the photo just in time, like as if they were trying to take it without him or something. But it's just like such a weird, so this guy has all these like weird occurrences. First, this sort of ghostly figure. And then later he has this, very strange experience where maybe there's some aspect of clairvoyance or ESP or maybe,
so he's kind of tapped in.
He's tapped in some way. And I mean, he does believe that he traveled through time. Like, I think, he's not sure about exactly what happened, but a moment of clairvoyance, I think, might be a little different than this feeling that you've actually traveled somewhere. But I mean, I don't know. I've never had that direct experience, but he definitely believed it. I don't know. What do you think? Like, I mean, I feel like, the difference between clairvoyance and seeing into the future and traveling to the future. I mean, is it just a matter of like consciousness, or, is it possible to physically travel? I don't know. I mean, what do you think about his story?
God, I don't know. It's pretty fascinating. And it does tie into the story that I'm going to share. I guess what I would really want to know is, did he describe any feelings that he had when he was going through those clouds, or anything that felt different or off?
Not that I read. I remember watching a show with him, and he talked about it. I don't remember if he's expressly said anything about like sensations or feelings he had, but when he talked about it, it's definitely like, like you can tell he had a feeling about the whole thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
That it was very strange and out of place. Like I think he even went on later into his life and to sort of like talk about UFOs and like ESP, and he was definitely affected in this way that to him, it was a supernatural experience.
So this was kind of like a gateway for him,
I guess.
Paranormal stuff.
Yeah. And this other thing with this, ghostly face. And it kind of seemed like he had these paranormal things happen to him multiple times throughout his life. But I don't know.
I feel like that is something that you see, though, where there are some people who, for whatever reason,
they're like a magnet.
Yeah, a magnet, or they're just more likely, whether they're more open. You know, there are different schools of thought on this stuff. I think, you know, in a future podcast, we can talk about ESP. There's like a really cool book that I've read before by a Harvard neurologist who actually described the brain as being like a filter. And like the way that she talks about it, I don't want to... kind of derail us. Basically, you know, there's a school of thought out there that, you know, like certain things can set us up to be more aware of dimensions or reality beyond just our five senses. And, you know, who knows, maybe this person was a little more sensitive.
Yeah, right. I mean, like we are, like our eyes, for instance, are certainly a filter, right? Like we definitely see like a very narrow band of light, right? Like if we saw all the light and sound and heard all the sounds that were out there, it'd be too much for us. Like we have to get this sort of narrow selection that lets us move through the world in a way that it doesn't, you know, it seems sensible and, you know, not overwhelming and not too chaotic, right?
Right. We've got a lot to deal with as it is.
Yeah. I mean, I think that people can certainly be,
but I think also there's like bias, you know? I mean, I think that,
what do you mean?
Well, I think like if you're just really adamantly closed off to it, to the idea of it, and you refuse, I think like, you know, just like, you know, the fact that you can take a sugar pill or something and it can affect a change in your body. I think that
right.
The mind is so powerful that you can close yourself off to the paranormal just by virtue of, you know, being unwilling to even consider the possibility.
I think that's true. And I think vice versa too. Like, and I think it's also like turn, like people have dreams in which they have premonitions, you know what I mean? And to a lot of people, it's the most natural thing in the world. And I think, you know, a lot of people,
I've had a few of those.
Oh, really?
I have. Yeah. But we need to save that for another episode.
Okay.
Too.
Okay. Maybe we should get into yours and then we can come back and bring this all together.
Cool.
You ready? Yeah. Ready to do yours?
I'm totally ready.
All right, cool.
Okay. So my story involves a pilot named Bruce Gernon. But this took place in the Bermuda Triangle, which I have a lot of love for because when I was growing up, the Bermuda Triangle was huge. It was everywhere. For our younger listeners who maybe haven't heard of it, the Bermuda Triangle is also called the Devil's Triangle, and it's a name given to a 500,000 square mile area of the Atlantic Ocean that boundaries Bermuda, Miami, Puerto Rico. It forms like a rough triangular shape in the ocean.
And which is like pretty big, right? Like Bermuda, like that triangle is like a huge chunk of the ocean.
Yeah, it's like 500,000 square miles. So
yeah.
But lore has kind of followed this area for many years. And it's pretty interesting. I didn't even know this before I started researching, but Christopher Columbus actually has a few accounts.
Oh, really?
In the ship's log. Yeah. Apparently when they were sailing through the Bermuda Triangle area, they recorded seeing a great fiery object fall out of the sky into the ocean. Which could be a meteor, you know, you could explain that away. But then a few weeks later, he records seeing a strange light in the distance.
Huh.
And they also had issues with erratic compass readings in the area, which is something that is mentioned time and time again, where people's navigation fails, their compasses go haywire, and they don't know where they are. And some scholars, like going way back again, even think that like Shakespeare's play The Tempest was based on a Bermuda Triangle shipwreck.
Oh,
and that
really?
Kind of added to its mystique. Yeah, I had no idea.
Yeah, me
But the mythology really didn't gain momentum until the 20th century when a series of ships and planes disappeared. And one of the most famous, a lot of people kind of say that this one was the big one that kind of launched the whole Bermuda Triangle lore, but it's Flight 19, and
a fleet of
five torpedo bombers went missing and were never heard from again. And another one more fun fact, the name Bermuda Triangle was used for the first time by author Vincent Gaddis in a 1964 magazine article. So he was the first one to coin that term.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. But by the 70s and 80s, there was a lot of hype about this, and people were really fascinated with triangle lore, all things Bermuda Triangle. So you saw it popping up on Unsolved Mysteries and other TV shows.
Right.
Time.
Time Life books.
I was just gonna say Time Life books. Yeah, like you and I both share that. Like we both have the Time Life books. And like a lot of other shows and books delve into this too, you know. And Milton Bradley put out a board game,
Really?
which I actually want. I
Oh my
saw that
God, we
there's
gotta
one on
find that.
Etsy. And Barry Manilow even did a song about it, which you really
Right,
need to
right, right.
hear.
Yes, no, I know, I need to hear it.
So the lyrics basically it rhymes triangle with my angle, which is brilliant.
Wow,
And
that's
we'll post a
Barry Manilow.
link, but you can find it on YouTube. It's pretty great. So there have been multiple explanations brought up through the years about why there are so many disappearances in this area. And I think like recently they've tried to debunk it and say, oh, it's just a matter of odds.
Or
There
yeah, you'll
really,
yeah,
there's no mystery.
right. Or there's even weird theories about like minerals in the ocean, and the other one's about like the, I mean, rogue waves, and which I think that's an interesting thought, but there's as many theories as there are debunks, about what's actually going on there. But the fact remains there are stories, and that's
There
what we
are
like.
lots of stories, right? And so some of the more straightforward, like you mentioned, the rogue waves. Well, there's also like magnetic fields, or maybe it's just unlucky odds. But there are some pretty out there ones that are like, let's face it, cooler. Like maybe, for instance, it's the location of the fabled lost continent of Atlantis. Maybe it's a vortex into another dimension. It could be an alien abduction hotspot. Some people have reported, I think, like UFOs going in and out of the water. Hey, you know, like Christopher Columbus saw. Sorry, my cat's climbing through this. I don't know if you can hear that. Sorry, Frances derailed this podcast.
That's okay. That's
Frances, she
okay. I'm
came to
just
say
keep going.
hi
That's
and
cool.
just
That's
sort
cool.
of, okay.
Francis can be part of the podcast.
Okay, but
I feel
I
like
think
there's a
my.
lot of cats in podcasts these days.
Okay, yeah, Francis, welcome. So, but basically, one of the last ones that I want to bring up, just because it's so crazy, is that maybe the Bermuda Triangle contains the gates of hell. Like it's a
Whoa,
portal
I haven't
into
heard that
hell
one.
itself. Yeah,
Oh, I
I've
guess I
brought that
have.
one
Yeah,
before.
right. They call it Devil's Triangle Portal into Hell. But I guess that's also not like a weird thought, right? Because like in the Odyssey, there was a place in the ocean that you went into, the underworld, right? That's like part of his journey, even. It's a little Greek mythology I'm just throwing in there.
Yeah, I think like you see like watery places a lot in mythology. But basically my story kicks off on December 4th of 1970 when Bruce Gernon, who was only 22 at the time, set off in a Beechcraft Bonanza A36 plane from Andros Island in the Bermudas to Miami. So they were heading toward Miami. It was exactly 3 p.m. when he left, and it had been raining earlier pretty heavily, but it had cleared up by now, so they had blue skies. And the trip was supposed to take about an hour and a half. He was there, his father was there, who was helping, he was like the main navigator, and they had a business partner along also. So there are three people in this little plane. And at this time, when they took off, Bruce radioed Miami to check on the weather conditions. And they told him, hey, it's clear most of the way, all the way from the Bahamas, you know, almost till Miami, except when you get there, there's a few scattered thunderstorms and you can easily navigate around them. However, when he took off and started flying, he saw this strange elliptical shaped cloud. And he described it as looking like a lenticular cloud, But those are usually found at heights of 20,000 feet, and this one was only around 500 feet above the ocean.
Oh wow. There's lenticular clouds, the ones that like kind of look like UFOs, right? Like,
Yeah,
like,
they're like rounded and spherical shaped clouds with like defined edges. So he decided to climb over it, and but as he climbed, he saw that the cloud was actually changing formation
Whoa.
and expanding at this incredible rate. So he said, "It had spread out all around me as far as I could see. My visibility was at least 10 miles. I was climbing at 110 miles an hour, and this cloud was spreading way faster than that. It caught up to the aircraft at about 4,500 feet, and visibility went down to nearly zero." So he broke free of the cloud, got above it, and then he could only get like 100 or 2 feet of 200 feet above it before it would catch up to him again because it was
Like it was
expanding. So
chasing, or like it was chasing,
yeah,
or
like it's expanding so
oh
quickly,
wow,
or trying to overtake the plane, whether there's any like consciousness behind this or not, I, you know, or I,
right. It
who
was just
knows?
getting bigger,
It
and
was just
like,
getting bigger and
yeah.
expanding at a crazy rate. And this happened like five more times where he would get just above it and the cloud would be expanding and grow and overtake him again, and he'd have to fly above it again. So finally, at 11,500 feet, they finally broke free of the cloud. And by this time, it had turned into what looked like a huge squall. But instead of like the typical jagged edges that that kind of a cloud would have normally, it was this perfectly curved semicircle. He described it as almost symmetrical looking. So it's a really weird, notable thing that he's seeing, you know, he's, you know, fascinated by this. So he continued flying and ran into another squall just like the one he'd escaped. And at that point, he realized that the storms were actually kind of wrapping around and joining together.
Oh,
So as they're
crazy.
expanding, they're forming this shape and sort of wrapping around and meeting.
Like sort of like a Mobius strip of like storms or clouds or whatever.
Yeah, he describes it like a donut.
Oh, crazy.
And then he said because he was young and according to him he was like pretty fearless, he decided to rely on his navigational instruments and actually enter the storm to kind of check it out. And he said that at first when he flew into it, it was pretty calm. He had pretty good visibility. He could see these flashes of lightning, but no bolts. So just sort of like it would like light up the clouds as he was flying. But as he got further into the clouds, the lightning flashes increased, and it got harder and harder to see in this dense, dark fog that now surrounded the plane. And it got to the point where it was like black and white, where it would be completely dark, and then the lightning would flash, and he'd have visibility for just a moment until it went dark
Whoa, that's
again.
really intense.
Yeah, it was super intense. So by this point, he's
Yeah.
like, okay, we got to get out of here. His dad's like, you know, probably was. Get the hell out of here.
Right.
So he adjusted his navigation and just headed due south to exit this storm. And he said, "I'm flying along the edge of the storm, and I can see how it's curving back toward where I'd come from. And I realize this thing is connected, and I'm trapped inside this huge donut-shaped storm with the inside opening that would be around 30 miles. I wasn't sure what to do, so I kept going. And then I saw where the two ends of the storm met." So basically, if you can envision this, it's just kind of coming together and, you know, like I said, sort of a donut shape. And where it met, the storm formed a valley between the clouds. And he said, "So I figured that opening is aiming toward Miami. I can just go through there." So he aims to go right through the eye of the storm. And as his plane starts going into the opening of this like donut storm, it formed a horizontal tunnel. So he's like flying the plane through a tunnel, and he estimates that it's about 10 miles long. And he said it was around 1,000 feet in diameter, but it appeared to be shrinking in size, so he could see it kind of shrinking in on his plane as he's flying. So he wanted to get out of there as quickly as he could and get to the other side, get to Miami. So he accelerated the plane to 230 miles an hour and headed straight into this opening. And he said, quote, "As soon as the aircraft penetrated, an amazing thing happened. Instantly, these strange lines formed, and they were like hovering maybe 500 feet from the walls of the tunnel. They were made up of a series of clouds about the size of a school bus, and they were broken apart but connected in a line. They continued all the way to the other end of the tunnel in a swirling type of motion, and it looked like looking through a rifle barrel where the spiral goes through it, and it was slowly rotating counterclockwise."
Wow.
It
It's
was
pretty crazy. I mean,
it's
like,
pretty crazy, right? So then he said that, like, at the other end of the tunnel, it just looked like bright blue skies with the sun shining in. So, like, the edges of these clouds had kind of a silvery sheen where the sun was hitting them, and the spinning clouds were sort of a dull gray color. So he figures, okay, this tunnel is about 10 miles long. It should take me about 3 minutes to get to the other end and get out of here. But it only took 20 seconds. So by the time he reached the other side, the tunnel had gotten so narrow that it scraped his wingtips because it was coming in so fast.
Wow. Like the edges of the tunnel being the clouds or whatever.
Yeah, the
Right,
clouds, like
right, right.
these swirling
But it's like contracted
clouds that are
around him
surrounding.
as he's moved through it.
Exactly, it's contracting around the plane.
Huh.
And then he said, right at this point was when I felt the only sensation that comes along with this experience. It was a really strange sensation of a combination of zero gravity and hydroplaning forward. And then he said, I do zero gravity all the time for fun when I go flying, but never the sensation of hydroplaning goes along with it.
Hydroplaning in the air, like, huh?
Yeah. Well, I don't know because I'm not a pilot. I've never flown a
Right,
plane.
right,
But
right.
I'm just sort of imagining it, kind of like a skinny
Sliding,
feeling.
yeah.
Yeah. So that lasted about 10 seconds, that sensation. And while that was going on, he looked behind him and saw the tunnel actually collapse and turn into just like a slit. And now the slit opening is rotating clockwise. And the clear blue sky that he had just entered instantly vanished. And now, and this is sounding more and more like your story, kind of, he said that he was in this strange fog and it was sort of a yellowish gray
Uh-huh,
color.
right.
And then all at once, this sensation of the zero gravity and the hydroplaning went away. And he looked at his instruments and he sees that his compass is spinning all by itself. So you have this like classic Bermuda
Right,
Triangle
right, right.
experience of
Like,
the compass going crazy.
yeah, all the instruments are going wacky, and yeah, something's external is influencing this.
Right. So he said that when he entered the tunnel, he was about 100 miles from Miami. And he verified it with his father, who was this expert navigator. But when he came out of the tunnel, he figured, okay, it's about 10 miles. He figured they were like still 85 or 90 miles from Miami. So he tried to verify it with his instruments. He wasn't able to get an accurate reading. He asked his dad to help. His dad couldn't get a position. The instruments were just clearly malfunctioning. So he contacted the Miami radio control and got a hold of them. And he told them, okay, I'm probably out about 85 miles east of Miami, but we're really not sure where we are. And they tried to locate them and they couldn't. And then they even like went so far as to switch to another radar center trying to get a location, and they couldn't. So this plane is like nowhere to be found on the radar. They're kind of lost to the world. And at this point, he said his dad started to panic and was like cussing out the radio controller, freaking out. And something else happened. It was really kind of strange. He said that the business partner who was riding with them started mumbling incoherently at the time. Like he was going through some kind of crazy experience that was affecting his brain. Like, whoa. And he said that, like, when this kind of thing happens, this isn't unusual. It's one of the effects that you can have. It can also make you feel kind of sick and nauseous, and like really disoriented. But he just has to focus on flying and getting them, you know, to Miami,
right,
he can.
They're out over the water now or something? Like, or
yeah, they're out on the other side of the... But they don't even know where they are.
Have no idea where they are.
Right, no one can locate them. So he said that after like a few minutes, another incredible thing happened. He said these strange lines formed around the airplane parallel to the direction of our flight. And then the lines turned into these cracks and they looked like slits. And he could see the blue sky on the other side of them. It was sort of like a rip. And he said they kept getting wider and wider. And so you could see more and more of the sky until they were completely gone. And then he was in totally clear blue sky. And so at that point, he turned around and he just expected to see a huge storm cloud or huge bank of clouds behind him, what he had just come through. And it was all blue sky.
Whoa, that's crazy.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
It's really weird. So, and at this very moment, the radio controller came back on the mic and he was yelling. He was super excited that he spotted their airplane and they're directly over Miami Beach. So Bruce looked at his watch and he saw that they'd only been in the air for about 33 minutes. So he said, so I should maybe be 80 miles or so east of Miami. And I told them, hey, you've got the wrong airplane. But then his eyes focused. He looks down and he sees Miami Beach directly below them. So this entire flight, which should have taken an hour and a half, only took 48 minutes. It was half the time. So Bruce really thinks that he traveled through time, that he experienced a kind of a time warp, and he calls the phenomenon that enabled this an electric fog or a time storm.
Right.
And he thinks that it's a rare but natural phenomenon that can make this happen. And the way he explains it, it's like the fog attaches itself to a vessel and sort of travels with it, and it causes these time distortions and disorientation and equipment problems. And he kind of thinks it's similar to St. Elmo's fire. And he says that he's encountered the same thing again, but like on a smaller scale years later in the 90s. But by that time he was older and he was a lot more afraid and he didn't want to go through that again. He wasn't as adventurous. Yeah.
Now didn't, I thought I heard like, in one version of the story that he had more gas left over than he should have. Not only did they get there in half the time, but they also had evidence, right? That they had, there was like more gas left over that supported that idea that it took them, that they basically traveled a shorter distance to get to Miami or burned less fuel. So if they had actually traveled that distance, literally they would have had to have burned a certain amount of fuel, and when they actually got there it remained unburned, meaning, you know, it supported this notion that they somehow traveled there faster or skipped some type of distance, some amount of distance to get there. Wasn't that part of that as well?
That's an interesting fact. I actually didn't come across it in my research, but that makes sense. And I mean, that's pretty cool.
It would make sense.
More hard proof.
Right. But yeah, definitely the fact that I think all their watches and stuff, if I remember, I haven't read this story in a while or heard it told, but I think there was something like that where it's like, yeah, it definitely there's records of when they left and when they landed. Right. And it did take the amount of time that they said. Right. So there's some evidence of something happening. Some phenomenon happens, right?
Plus the eyewitness of his father, who was an expert navigator.
Right. These people experience something, and this idea of the fog is really interesting. I mean, you know, like, I feel like the deeper science gets into quantum mechanics and, you know, the theory of relativity and all this stuff, you know, I think, you know, even Stephen Hawking talked about how gravity is actually unstable, that, you know, the space-time continuum can have weird tears and, you know, and holes, and it's porous in a way that maybe we don't really understand yet. And so the idea that, you know, that something could slip through or something like that for a moment, or I don't know, it doesn't seem that out there to me.
Yeah, this doesn't seem very crazy. I mean, the story itself doesn't seem crazy. It's not right. Like they saw flying dragons or, right. You know, I mean, they're not describing anything that's beyond
their possibility. They're describing a natural phenomenon, just like you said. Like, whatever it was a natural phenomenon, right? These weird clouds and this, you know, seeing the sky change. And I mean,
right. You know, it's interesting that your story had the clouds.
I know,
like,
isn't
the strange
that cool?
Colors. Yeah. And yeah, that's why I was asking you, like, if he described his sensations.
Yeah. But yeah, it's interesting. Like just this notion that, you know, out there, if, you know, out there somewhere in the air that there's, you know, these natural occurring phenomenon that people have experiences in. You know what I mean? Like, whatever happened, we don't necessarily know, but something happened that, you know, that they had a direct experience with. You know, I'm sure there's all kinds of weird weather, you know, and I'm sure these pilots are experienced to some degree, but there's also, you know, something, you know, I guess paranormal, supernatural about it. And supernatural just means we just don't understand it, right? I mean, a black hole is supernatural until they photographed it, right?
Right, exactly.
Until it just became
exactly.
part of the
and
natural
it used
universe.
To be like a subject of science fiction.
Yeah, exactly. And so, I don't know, I think it's these are both really cool stories, and I'm glad they have so many like similarities, and yet they happen in different parts of the world. Obviously, you know, my story happened, you know, in Scotland and in England. But in a very similar type of circumstance. And
right.
There's all these stories from pilots. I feel like they've always been in the center of these sort of phenomenon, but somehow, you know, their testimony is often discounted, even though, you know, it's like, you know, especially in the military, to be a pilot, like, you have to have a certain like stable type of personality. And, you know, like I think even in modern times, they, you know, they have psychological evaluations, you know, especially for like fighter pilots and stuff. And so, you know, I mean, I think the original, you know, flying saucer was spotted by an Air Force pilot. You know, the Air Force just released all those, the footage of the, you know, the, you know, admitted that they've been seeing UFOs for a long time, you know, like these guys see stuff, they experience stuff, and we trust them to fly us from one part of the world to another. But when they're like, oh no, these things definitely happen, we're like, yeah, but you're probably just tripping, you know, you know,
yeah,
like Foo Fighters and all that, right? You know, the Foo Fighters from, was it World War II or World War I or whatever? You know, the balls of, there were balls of light that would follow the planes and like kind of mm-hmm. mess with them while they were flying around. That's where the Foo Fighters come from.
Mm-hmm. Which also makes me think of ball lightning, another subject.
Yes, we'll definitely do. We should do like a ball lightning. And what's the one that's like the weird ones like in the bogs or something?
Swamp gas.
No, swamp gas, but there's like, oh, St. Elmo's fire.
St. Elmo's fire.
Yes, yeah. We'll do it on the movie and the phenomenon.
Cool.
Well, those were cool. Those were fun. I'm glad we did that. So they're so specific to each other, but like it's like time travel, but it's like time traveling pilots or something.
Exactly.
Yeah. Cool. And so yeah, maybe we'll do something different coming up. I mean, I still want to do like a synchronicity episode. I still want to do you know, a ghost town, or I like when we do these like super specific ones, because I feel like they get more niche or something.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it also kind of opens up more stories, you know,
yeah,
because I feel like
yeah.
when you look into any, you know, well-known paranormal topic, there are always like the headliners.
Yeah, there's the headliners, right.
And right. Like, so we're kind of delving in a little bit deeper.
Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking about the guy who did, who built the Integratron. Do you know that place out in, was it like Landers near Joshua Tree outside of LA? And he built this thing, and maybe we'll do a story about him. And it was about like, was supposedly he was building it to be able to like view the past and future remotely and all this just like weird stuff. And just it's reminded me, just this subject has sort of reminded me of that. And yeah, maybe we'll do a story about that one too.
Yeah, we should. Also, like dark matter.
Dark matter, yeah.
Weird science.
Yeah, let's do some weird science ones.
Okay.
All right, cool. Well, that was fun.
Very cool.
So I guess we're all done then.
I guess we're done.
Okay, until next time.
Until next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.